This is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I'm speaking with Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins. The song A Stitch in Time is really, really gorgeous. Did the song stay pretty close to your original demo?
Well, all I really had was just an acoustic version, and everyone agreed that that was the way to go, to not turn it into a sort of band song.
Right.
So for me, the challenge became, can we keep it feeling like an acoustic song, but can we produce it in a way that gives it some more emotional energy?
Right.
And I really thought of somebody like Donovan, the artist Donovan, who did a really good job of
that.
Yeah. Because he wrote a lot of his songs, obviously, on acoustic, and yet somehow his music was able to kind of convey something a little more exotic. I recorded a track, and then I did the vocal, so we would basically had the acoustic version of the song. And then you would kind of just futz around with different ideas, different approaches to try to come up with a sort of an interesting orchestration to convey, you know, an emotional value through the song. And yeah, it was a really fun process. I mean, it was interesting because it was very trial and error. I didn't think it was going to turn out as maybe pretty as it sounds.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Donovan, because there is a bit of a 60s vibe to it. And of course, now there's the sitar. Is that an actual sitar or choral sitar?
It's a choral electric that I bought somewhere in Florida along the way. But it's the 60s.
Yeah.
One thing I guess I should point out, as we were talking about earlier, a little bit about influences. Tiergarten, for me, is an album that sort of is almost like a person looking past, present, and future all at the same time, and
okay,
trying to have that perspective. So part of my logic is that emulating and at times paying homage to artists that influence me is, in a way, telling part of my story.
Right.
So in the past, where I would have been much more egoistically concerned about whether or not influences could be spotted, because, of course, I wanted all the attention to go towards me or the band, you know, as if we were sort of creating music out of a vacuum.
Okay.
This, for me, is more like letting someone in into like an attic, you know, and saying, here's the thing I built, here's the thing I copied, here's the thing I dreamed about that got discarded. And so there are moments where it's sort of reflective in a kind of a sentimental way, and then there are times where it's sort of wholly futuristic and is about abandoning the past. So it's an interesting way to approach, because it's much different than what I used to do.
Seeing as you said that, that brings up a question. Is this scary for you, this sort of new way of writing, new way of recording, this new mentality?
No, not at all. I'm actually really excited, because I think what happened with me is that we had such tremendous success in the 90s, and you know, I just kind of kept making up new rules, and they kind of kept working. Well, at some point, they just stopped working as effectively. Now, somebody could say that was because, you know, I lost something, or things change, or, you know, whatever happens, that, you know, everybody goes through those cycles.
Yeah.
But I think what ended up happening was, the way my brain works is I sort of abandoned the approaches that I had in many ways, because I thought, okay, right, I've just got to get on something else. And so I left a lot of threads that were laying there that were really good. And the whole point through the 90s for me was to push boundaries and try to get somewhere new.
Right.
And sometimes we did that, and other times we really failed. But I feel like I'm back in that headspace, but not in the shadow of the past.
Okay.
That took me a while. So what I was trying to say is, through the decade between, say, 2001 and, you know, 2000-something, you know, a lot of that time was about somehow trying to wrestle with the shadow of what had been done in the past.
Right.
For me, this past year is really been the first time, maybe it started with the American Gothic EP that we put out, but is the first period since the 90s where I feel like I'm not in any shadow anymore. You know, I've let it go. You know, I learned my lesson. I appreciate and honor what worked about it, and the parts that don't work, it doesn't bother me anymore. It's like, okay, time to move on. I'm back in that space where I'm really excited, and I don't know what's coming around the next corner, but it's much better than living in that shadow of like, well, should I do this because people expect that? And, oh, no, they expect that, so I'm going to do this to fuck with their heads. I've let go of all that stuff.
Is it liberating because, you know, when you did first come out with Gish, it was like, okay, you're alt-rock or you're grunge, and
right,
you know, and this is expected of you. You got to sound like this and talk to these kind of fanzines. Is it liberating now that those restrictions aren't really placed on you?
I think they're still placed on me. I just don't pay any attention to them. You know what I mean?
Like, what would be placed on you?
Well, you know, I find it really interesting where I'm still held up to what would be called alternative rock standards. You know, the way I marketed my music or the way I do certain things, I'm held up to a certain standard that all the subsequent generations, you know, for the past 15 years haven't been. So if somebody from American Idol does a cool commercial, those same people write about how it's kind of clever and funny and look the other way for the fact that the person is completely selling their soul. Somebody like me is still supposed to represent some value that really doesn't mean that much anymore. And personally, I wish those values did mean something. I wish there was a reason to uphold those values across the board culturally, because I think those were good values to have. I think the values that great artists like Kurt Cobain and Neil Young and Johnny Cash, you know, all represented, those were important. People like me look to people like them to kind of give a sense that there was a bigger picture involved than whether or not it was good for your career or something like that. And I took a lot of inspiration from those artists and many others that had great ethics and great concepts of ethics. Those are all gone now. So basically people talk about the ethics, but they don't really mean anything anymore.
Right.
So I still hear that and feel that, but I think this doesn't have anything to do with the survival and the future of the Smashing Pumpkins, which is ultimately what I have to be concerned about. And so I'm really happy to be in a place where I sort of just stuck my flag in the sand and said, okay, this is what I'm going to do for the next 3 or 4 years. Like it, don't like it, it's cool, but this is what I'm going to do. And because I've placed the core of my energy back on music and not on all the other stuff that I used to worry about,
right,
including having a dysfunctional band or two, I feel like that's put me back at the center of my ethics, not somebody's opinion of what it should be like. You know, I'm being more led by the spirit of what I'm doing than whether or not it makes sense to some blogger somewhere. Because most of those people aren't living in the reality that I have to live in, which is you have a completely decimated music business. The labels that exist have basically turned into nothing but bread and cookie sellers.
Right.
The creativity is gone in many cases, and even if there's creativity there, they don't have the resources. The public has moved on into many other things. Music is no longer the central sort of cultural guide like it was for many, many years. So people like us still have to wake up and look at a bunch of rubble and figure out, okay, what do I do with this? You don't have the ability to pretend you're new.
Right.
And play whatever new fantasy is going on. You have to sort of live with where you come from. And I'm fine. I think one part of that for me is being willing to admit that I've made mistakes and have some real contrition about where maybe I was misguided, but maybe in my heart I thought I was doing the right thing. I think I'm just in a good, humble place where I just want to go back to being a musician. And at the end of the day, I think the best way to judge an artist is wait till they're done and then, you know, sort of add up the things that they did, and then you can decide whether or not their life was worth something. But if you read most critical review of artists as they go along, most people really miss the point, because it's really hard in real time to even understand what an artist's real influence is.
Sure.
If you compare it against the current cultural value, well, most times artists are on the edge of something or in advance. It's hard sometimes to imagine why they're doing what they're doing, but that's why they're artists. They have an alternate brain pattern. Anyway, ranting.
It's quite all right. Let's go to the last two songs that you have posted so far. Now, there's Widow Wake My Mind,
mm-hmm.
which, wow, great opening riff. Does a song like that start with the riff, or do you have the main section of the song before you get that riff?
Actually, in the beginning, I just had the two parts, just the, oh, oh, oh.
Right.
And then I had the chord changes for the chorus. And a lot of times when I write songs like that, I think, oh, that's a dumb song. I do. I just think, oh, that's kind of a silly song or something.
Oh, boy.
And then 3 days later, I'm in the kitchen making a cup of tea, and it's still in my head. So I try to listen to that part of myself. Yeah, I like that it has kind of a cute charm to it, you know?
Mike Byrne does some amazing drumming on that.
Mm.
You had mentioned that you guided, for lack of a better word, Jimmy on some of his playing. Do you find yourself giving Mike direction, or does he just kind of intuitively know what to do?
Oh, yeah. No, he's probably sick of hearing me talk. But I'm quick to point out that Jimmy and I had the same collaboration process.
Okay.
You know, that what Jimmy made sound so effortless was the result of a lot of talking and a lot of work and really kind of focusing what the drums were trying to say. And I think that's why Jimmy was so successful in so many different ways of playing an incredibly busy drum style and still having it be part of pop music. But there's a thin line there where if you get too busy or it doesn't have a good focus or a story to tell, it doesn't sort of do what it's supposed to do.
Right.
You know, so I like to think of our music as sort of organized chaos. And so what'll happen a lot, for just a little insight, is like I'll sort of explain to Mike, okay, this is kind of the emotional feeling we're looking for. This is kind of the approach we're looking for. You go from there where you want to go. And if you actually have a vision of somewhere else you want to go, we'll try that.
Okay.
And then so he'll kind of develop his ideas, then we'll actually go through and we'll say, that's working, that's a little bit, I know what you're trying to do, and we just kind of work through like that. And I think it's been a satisfying process. I think it's really starting to click in his head now that his role is just as critical to how the songs come across. It's not just a beat-driven or a
right.
hey, I just want to play this fill, because everything falls under that microscope in our process.
He does sound organic in the song. I mean,
well, that's the beauty, yeah. I mean, he's playing very busy at times, but that's the beauty of it, is he worked it out in a way that he's able to play like himself, play busy, and at the same time not subvert the song.
And lastly, we have, and you've talked about this a bit, A Song for a Son.
Right.
Now, was that written on piano?
No, it was acoustic.
Oh, okay. What kind of acoustics are you playing these days?
I have some really nice ones, 60s and 70s, and maybe even a few 40s and 50s, so I just kind of pick up whatever. I think for that one, I probably used a Gibson J200, probably like a mid-60s.
Okay.
Kind of the same one Elvis played, whatever that sort of bigger body J200 with the stripe down the middle. It's sort of like cook in the kitchen, you know. I try to think of what tone I would want. I have this Epiphone acoustic, which is similar to the sort of the same model without a pickup that John Lennon played in the Beatles.
Okay, yeah.
Sort of early 60s. That's a very metallic sounding.
Yes.
And I think that's what I used on Stitch in Time. I don't have a favorite one, because for me it's always about what's the right guitar for the song.
But you don't have so many that you can't figure out which one to use.
I have more than I use, let's put it that way.
This might be a hard question, but are you talking about your childhood in any kind of way in this song? It sounds like it.
A song like that's interesting, because when I wrote it, I really didn't have anything in my mind other than a sort of a feeling.
Okay.
And it wasn't until I finished the song and listened to it a few times that I really realized it had a lot to do with my relationship with my father.
Right.
But I didn't think that when I wrote the song, which is kind of why it's weird to me. But that's what it seems to be about. Something to do with legacies and, you know, what our fathers pass on to us, and something to do with that. But I like that it's sort of vague, you know?
It is vague, but one definitely does get that feeling from the song, which, of course, led me to the question.
Mm.
Is it harder to write a song like that and sort of dig all that out of your soul, or is it harder to talk about it once it's done and explain it?
Sometimes it can be difficult if a song's triggering a particular set of emotions. I've never had difficulty talking about songs, other than I think that talking about them in some way sort of narrows down, because I know that I've listened to many, many songs, and I don't know what the hell they're about. But they trigger a certain set of emotions in me that might remind me of going to high school or something.
Yeah.
And I know, listening, that the song's got nothing to do with that. In that way, you could say the song's got enough energy in it that it's able to trigger different things for different people. And I think that's what the best music does, is it sort of gives you an individual experience without necessarily imposing the experience. You know, like if you think of a great songwriter, somebody like Neil Diamond.
Right.
He was able to write songs in a way that you kind of felt like he was talking about you, even though you knew he was talking about himself.
Yeah.
Whereas Neil Young is the type of songwriter where you really feel he's talking about Neil, but somehow because he's talking about Neil, he's talking about you. Which is different. Bob Dylan's always talking about somebody else, and you're never sure if he's talking about him or you.
Right.
You know? So everybody does it differently. I think my best songs, somehow I'm able to have them be very personal, but they don't seem to turn off somebody's ability to find something personal in them, and I think that's when I've gotten right. I've tried to write more impersonal songs, and I find that people don't respond to them. No, seriously.
Like what? Example.
Perfect example, I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but if I sing I,
right,
or the song seems to be I'm singing something about myself or related to me, that seems to work better for people connecting with the songs than if I sing about you.
Okay.
Where Bob Dylan always sings you.
That's true.
Not always. But for the most part, he's always like, you and you. And
you.
And it works.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because he's talking about somebody else. And you're like, yeah, you know. But he's really talking about you.
That's very interesting. Last question, and you did touch on this a little bit. You feel this is the best lineup you've had. There are those, as I'm sure you know, that love and embrace the lineup that you had in the 90s. They would call it the classic lineup. Does that concern you in any way, that just some people will never be able to get past that and let you do what you need to do to push into the future? I'm sure you recognize that.
Oh, yeah. I've kind of let go of it, because for a while I tried to sort of try to explain, like, oh, well, you know, there's nothing I can do. Or I even said to fans at one point, like, well, if we put that band up, I don't know how functional that band would be at this point. That doesn't mean anything, I think, to a fan. And if I was a fan, I would feel the same way. I think the beautiful thing is that there's 4 or 5 records there, plus other songs, probably about 200 songs that band churned out.
Yeah. I got
so
a box
a lot,
of
and there's a lot of video
EPs.
In the vaults, and so there's a lot of stuff still that can people will be able to explore and really see what was good and bad about that band. Of course, I have a different experience because I was inside, but I totally get, as best as I can, why people were attracted to that band. That band had an interesting darkness to it that when it was on stage, it had an incredible electricity to it. I'm not sure why, other than it just worked, and it worked basically from the beginning. And I would be careful to say that when one of the members left, when Jimmy left during the Adore period, and then subsequently when Darcy left, Jimmy came back, and then Darcy left during the Machina period, I really felt the imbalance. It was not the same. It wasn't like 75% as good. It was like 50% as good. Something about not having the four people in the room. So all I can say is that I'm really proud to continue under the Smashing Pumpkins name. I'm proud of the past. And I think the best way to honor the past is to be in the present. I always get really uneasy when the present is too much about the past, because the past wasn't about the past.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That band from 1988 to 2000 was very much about being in the moment. So that's the only thing I would say to a fan is, I'm just trying to be in the moment I'm in. If it's good enough, great. And if it's not, or it doesn't sort of register in your mind as what you need to hear or see, that's totally cool. I don't have any problem with that. Because ultimately music is a personal thing, and no amount of intellectual explanation is going to change that. I think if somebody gets hung up strictly on the lineup as an issue only,
right,
then that seems to be a little bit silly. But if you don't have a problem and then you listen and you're not satisfied with what you're hearing, it doesn't have the same energy coming out of the speakers, or you go to see the band, it doesn't have the same whatever you liked about the old band, that's totally fair. I mean, that's everybody's right to feel that way.
Well, I'm loving what I'm hearing so far.
Great, thank you.
The four songs, I look forward to hearing the next 40.
Yeah.
Hopefully it won't take as
Big
long
prayer
as...
for me.
This is going to take a year or two, right?
I don't know. I mean, I my general estimate is between 3 and 4 years.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah, I figure a song about every 4 to 6
yeah.
weeks. So
it's wonderful stuff so far, and again, I look forward to the rest. And
great.
Billy, thank you very much for taking all this time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot.
This is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I've been speaking with Billy Corgan. Billy, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, you take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.